Thank you. Thank you all for coming. This is my first time in Berlin. I've had a heck of a great time. It's very cool to be invited here to come speak to you folks. My first question was, why the heck do you want me to come to this conference? I said, well, hey, the name of the conference is Here Be Dragons, and we heard you made a movie called Here Be Dragons, so that's good enough. Come on, talk. But what's the movie about? We don't know. We don't care. It doesn't matter. So I'm going to show you just about the first 40 seconds of the movie here, which is just the very beginning introduction part, and it tells you.
In ancient times, unexplored regions on maps would often be given fearsome legends like Here Be Dragons. Unknowns were frightening, and it gave some comfort to at least be able to label the unknown. Hypothesized dragons seemed a good enough explanation for what would otherwise be ungraspable. With a made-up concept and a few words, the unknown becomes simple and satisfying.
Thank you all very much for coming. We'll see you next week. That's actually an urban legend, as I'm sure has been mentioned more than once during this conference already. There are actually no known ancient maps that say Here Be Dragons on them. There's one globe about this big called the Lennox Globe from 500 years ago that says Here Be Dragons over Asia. And they weren't even talking about dragons. It was what Marco Polo called the Chinese people. It was the kingdom of, oh, I'm going to get it wrong, Dagroyan, something like that. So that's what my podcast is about at skeptoid.com. It's basically about critical thinking, looking at urban legends, things that most people believe that to be true, that are promoted in the media as true, that aren't true. And so I try to find really interesting topics that a lot of people generally believe, and we just look at them in detail, do a lot of research. I have a lot of research assistants that help me. We spend a lot of time digging into these stories, digging up old information, and it's really far more interesting when you learn the truth about something than when you accept the popular myth. And one of the most popular articles or episodes that I did is called The Missing Cosmonauts. And just to give you a little bit of background about what the episode was, right after World War II, during the Cold War, when the United States and the Soviet Union were engaged in the space race, they were trying to launch Sputnik, we were trying to launch Explorer 1. There was a lot of competition. It was a very political competition. It was all about propaganda. Everyone was trying to be the first in space. And, of course, we know that the Soviets were the first to have a person in space with Yuri Gagarin. They were the first to have Sputnik launched. Of course, we were the first to have little Albert the monkey launched in 1948 aboard a captured V-2 rocket. Albert, unfortunately, died in the attempt, but he gets credit for being the first semi-astronaut. During this period, there was two brothers, Achille and... Who speaks Italian here and can correct my pronunciation? I'm sure someone does. One, Achille and Giovanni Giudica Cordelia. Is that close? Close enough. Thank you very much. These were two young brothers in their 20s. They scavenged radio equipment. And when the Soviets launched Sputnik, they published this frequency on which they were going to be broadcasting it so that everyone in the world could see how superior they were. Well, they found some radio equipment and actually tuned into it and got it. During the subsequent years, over the early 1960s, they expanded their operation. They actually took over an old World War II bunker in Italy, and they built this radio observatory that they called Torre Bert. Every time that something was happening in space, anytime anyone was launching anything, Torre Bert was filled with college professors, news reporters. They even had people from Italian intelligence who befriended them and kept a close eye on what they were doing. And the girlfriends would be there, lots of a big party every time. This picture with the white lab coats, I'm sure, was staged for a camera. I don't think it looked like that most of the time. That dish you see is the biggest dish that they had. It was about 16 foot across, 3 meters? 5 meters. I'm horrible. And they had this a car that they would drive out so that they could get some distance away, and that would let them triangulate on where signals were coming from. They learned quite a bit about how to detect, how to analyze these radio signals. Using the Doppler effect, they could compute the speed and the altitude of wherever the satellite was coming from. This is the actual recording that they made of Sputnik 1. Let's try that again. One thing that was great about what the brothers did was they kept a very detailed, very meticulous library. And it is truly a national treasure, their library of all these early space recordings. Because there were so many people in Torrey Burt when they made the recordings, they have a very good provenance. The recordings are very authentic. We know a great deal about that each one was real. None of them are faked. None of them are hoaxed. And it truly is a fantastic library. Now, shortly after Sputnik 1, they launched Sputnik 2, which had a little dog on board. And they didn't know that at the time, but when they heard this recording, they said, "What the heck is that?" Well, the brother's father was a cardiologist, and he said, "That's a dog's heartbeat." He knew it right away. And sure enough, the Soviets announced that they had launched Laika into space. And kind of like Albert the monkey, Laika didn't have a good time. There was no provision at all made for returning Laika to Earth. They just launched her up into space. She's still out there somewhere circling, probably. Poor little thing. She was cute. So then things started to get a little bit more grim. In November of 1960, when there is no known flight, there is no record in the Soviet space history of a flight being launched on the day that this was recorded. We don't have any audio of this, unfortunately, but it was an SOS. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, repeating. Hand-keyed, it wasn't mechanical. And what was creepy about it was that they detected zero relative speed. And they interpreted this to mean that it was headed straight out away from the Earth, as if something had malfunctioned and the craft didn't orbit enter orbit. It just went straight off into space. This was on one of their space frequencies, so this was not coming from a ship at sea. Well, this is obviously kind of creepy, but it got even creepier. Here's one from February of 1961. The cardiologist father said, "That is the heartbeat of someone who's dying. That's like the final stages of a heart attack. That man's dying." And again, this came on a space frequency. And again, it came from a day when there was no known flight. Thank you. That reminded me to turn my cell phone off. Okay, here's one more. Listen to this one. This one's really creepy. The main reason people loved this episode of my podcast was because of how creepy this particular recording is. Kind of sounds to me like he was snoring, but it's. Listen to it again. Whoops, that's the wrong one. Well, the Soviets have no great hero who flew in space on that day and came back to great fanfare and applause. So we have to assume that whoever this was either did not survive the attempt, or maybe it wasn't a space flight. But again, it was on one of the space frequencies. The brothers were able to tell which one were the space frequencies for certain because they openly worked with NASA in the United States. They flew back and forth and they exchanged information with each other. And there's kind of some funny stories around that. The Italian brothers would be on one side of the table, the NASA guys would be on the other side of the table. Each one wants to learn something, but nobody wanted to tell the others anything. And so it was almost like a funny scene from a movie, how that conversation went. This is the one that we're going to talk about most today. Let me just see a show of hands. How many people in here speak Russian? It's a hackers conference, so I know I'm going to see some hands. How many are lying and haven't raised your hands and they actually do speak Russian? But Okay, there's a few in here. I might ask for your help, actually, when we're done with this. And again, before I proceed, let me see another show of hands. How many have heard this story before, or some part of this story, about the Judica Cordelia brothers? Okay, maybe 10% of you. And in general, what people think who know about this is it's a genuine cover-up, right? We know that the Soviets were trying to... It was a propaganda war. We know that someone did die in space. They sure as heck weren't going to announce it. And it seems perfectly plausible that this would be a real cover-up. That's certainly what I thought, and that's certainly what I would expect most people to think. So now let's listen to the Ludmila recording. May of 1961. Remember that date, May of 1961. The translation that's here on the screen is the popular translation that you'll find all over the internet. When she says, talk to me, it's in, as in, please talk to me. You're not answering me. Please talk to me. It's that kind of talk to me. And I'm hot sounds like she's in distress, like I'm burning up. She can see a flame. And she sounds terrified when she's asking, is she going to crash? And will she re-enter? Well, things like hot and flame and crash and re-enter, that certainly sounds like a space flight, doesn't it? Anyway, this recording goes on for several minutes. Now, we do know that they did erase cosmonauts out from the history books. Look at this picture. Look at the tall gentleman in the back row. Whoops, where did he go? Now you see him, now you don't. And if you put these two pictures in Photoshop and overlay them on top of each other, you can tell they are the same picture. Here's one more. Notice the gentleman sitting in the back row on the right-hand side of the screen up there. Bloop, he's gone. Now this picture, these are not actually the same picture. These were taken very close together. There's quite a few differences when you overlay the pictures on top of each other. You can look at the positions of fingers and mouths and eyeballs. So these were taken very close together. Is it possible this guy simply ducked down? Well, yes, it is. But these pictures do have histories. This guy has been identified. This tall guy back there has been identified. This guy was someone who was just renowned for getting into brawls. He got into fights. He got beat up. He got cut from a flight. He got angry. He then committed suicide. They wiped him out of the history books. He didn't die in space. And this guy is just another guy who washed out of the program for some reason. At least, that's the official story. And you can always say, well, that's just the cover-up. You know, he actually did die in space. And so they said, oh, he was just a dishonorable guy who was out brawling and fighting, so that's why we cut him out of the pictures. So, you know, there's kind of reasons why these conspiracy theories might be true. But there are reasons why Ludmila's flight, this flight with the woman speaking in Russian about how she's dying and burning up, there are good reasons why this cannot possibly be a woman cosmonaut. And these are the things that I talked about when I did my podcast episode, but after we're done with this, I'm going to go a little bit further into it. So by being here, you're going to learn more than you would have learned had you ever listened to my podcast, which probably none of you did. Okay, first of all, no corroborating reports from any other countries. This is huge, and this is pretty hard to get past. These two brothers with their radio antennas sitting on top of their World War II bunkers got recordings and claimed that Soviet flights happened on days when the Americans, the Canadians, the Germans, the British, and the French never found anything. And look at the type of equipment that these nations had. They had giant tracking dishes. The Judica Cordelia brothers did not have tracking dishes. They couldn't follow something as it went across the sky. And again, this was a propaganda war. It was all about propaganda. The Americans especially would have loved nothing better than to report a Soviet failure. Well, why didn't we report any Soviet failures? Probably because we never detected any. If we had been able to confirm that these Judica Cordelia brothers' recordings were indeed failed Russian space flights, we would have loved to report it, and there was no such report made. And this was a time of pretty decent sophistication. The Defense Early Warning System, the North American Air Defense Command, SAC-NORAD, these things had all been in place for several years by the time these recordings happened. Another reason is that there were no female cosmonauts and weren't yet for quite some time. May 1961 is when the recording happened. The Soviet space program was extremely political, and although a lot of it was classified until relatively recently, since then we've learned just about all the details. We know who had breakfast with who on what morning. We knew which astronauts were friends with the other. We knew what the little infighting and political squabbles they had between them. We know all about the cosmonauts who were going through the training program, and there were no women at the time in any of these flights. There was a female cosmonaut program. It wasn't even approved until months after the Lyudmila recording happened. And when the first five women were selected, it was, another 2 years before the first one, Valentina Tereshkova, before she ever actually flew. None of the others did. And just to give one little quick example of how political this program was, if you see, does my little laser beam work? There it is. This woman up here, her name was, I can't pronounce it, but it's Pono something. I'll just call her Pono for short. She was actually the leading runner. Valentina Tereshkova came from a textile family. She was a low-class worker. And it came down to asking them one question. The question they asked both of these women was, why do you want to be a cosmonaut? Pono said, to be all that I can be and to do all that I can do with my life. They said, okay, fine. Valentina Tereshkova, why do you want to be a cosmonaut? She said, to serve the Soviet state. Well, guess who got to fly? So there were no female cosmonauts, and there's really no way that there could have been a female cosmonaut in the program anywhere that we wouldn't know about. And here's another reason why it's absolutely impossible. The timeline simply was impossible to get another flight in between. Okay, this Lyudmila recording happened in May 1961. Between Vostok 1 and between Vostok 2. There's no time for a Vostok 1.5. Did you know that their resources were so limited that when German Titov flew, they had to scavenge Yuri Gagarin's spacesuit to make another spacesuit for Titov? They were that strapped on resources. They didn't even have two complete spacesuits. The idea that they could have secretly put together another one of these Vostok R7 boosters, I mean, it's really strains credibility. They simply did not have the resources to put something together. Vostok 1 and Vostok 2 were scheduled well in advance. We knew for years that these guys were going to fly on these flights. There's just no way that there could have been a Vostok 1.5 with a woman on it. So it's pretty clear that the Lyudmila recording was not a doomed cosmonaut. And that's pretty much where I ended it when I did my podcast episode. My episodes are short. They're only 10 minutes long. And so I didn't have time to go very much deeper into it. But of course, the question everyone asked was, okay then, smart guy, who the heck was she, and what was this recording? We know it's a legitimate recording. We know that. We know it came on a space frequency. We know it came in May 1961. We know that there was other people in the room who could verify that it was a genuine Soviet recording. So who was she, and what the heck was she was doing? Well, that's a tough question, and it's a good question. And that's where the power of critical thinking really comes in. Because it's easy to stop at the popular explanation. It's easy to read on the internet about these lost cosmonauts and say there was a Soviet conspiracy. Conspiracy theories are really fun. They're really satisfying. They really stroke a lot of our needs. You know, we love to feel that we're part of something important, that we're part of, you know, the elite who knows the truth when most people are having the wool pulled over their eyes. But it's not as satisfying as digging further and finding out what actually happened. So let's see if we can dig further into the Lyudmila recording and see who the heck she actually was. Well, first thing to do is to try and track down the name Lyudmila. If you look on the internet, and that's actually more useful now than it was even just a few years before, because a lot of Russian records have been put onto the internet. You can find references to two women named Lyudmila. I'm going to pronounce these wrong, but I'm just going to say it. Sarakovna and Tukovny. You can find all sorts of stories about them. One of them supposedly had a husband, and they died together in space. These are all just stories. There is no legitimate records of any of these things happening. There's no legitimate records of either of these two women named Lyudmila. And I tried and tried and tried, and I could not find any record of how the name Ludmila got connected with this particular recording. There doesn't seem to be any reason that it should be, except that there was these two women believed to be named Ludmila who were allegedly in the cosmonaut program at the time, before there was a cosmonaut program for women. So what could she have been doing while she was making this recording? Does anyone recognize this bad boy right here? Shout it out. It's not often seen in titanium white. That's what may throw you off. That's the American X-15, the space plane that was flying at this time in history. Could it go high and fast enough that it might be re-entering, that you might say, I'm burning up, I'm going to re-enter, am I going to crash? Well, yes, it did. It was able to go Mach 6.7. It flew into space. Two astronauts actually earned their wings flying the X-15. And since it was operational during the time of the Ludmila recording, wouldn't you expect, gee, I bet the Soviets had something similar? I certainly would. You could see that it flew into space, it got high enough, it could do a controlled re-entry. You had re-entry heating, which is when Ludmila could have been saying, help me, I'm going to burn up, I'm re-entering. And then it would land like an airplane. So I think it's a pretty good candidate. So let's take a look and see what the Soviets had going at that time. Did they have an X-15 analog or something like it? Now you've got to look at the way that the Soviet design bureaus worked. These were even more political, and they worked in such a stupid way, it was hilarious. Each design bureau had a designer who was at the head. And whenever he got in trouble or someone didn't like him, they'd fire him. But when they fired the head of the design bureau, they canceled his entire bureau and canceled all of his projects. And the whole program was out of a job. As a result, every time they did this, they had to start back at square one with a new design bureau working on their own designs. This particular space plane, this design bureau got canceled in 1960, so it never got past the drawing board stage. I think it's pretty cool looking. I mean, it looks fairly modern. It looks almost like our lifting body planes that we had flying much later. So the VKA-23, yes, if it had been built, it might be a possibility for Ludmila to have been flying one of those. But it just wasn't built. Here's another one, a very similar story from another design bureau, also canceled the year before Ludmila flew. This was called an orbital glider, which I don't quite understand because it's got orbital maneuvering engines. So, and a main engine. How is that a glider? I don't know, but that's how it's always referred to. Again, it never got past the drawing boards. Not a single piece of hardware was ever built. This one, on the other hand, they actually did build hardware. They were going for a space plane fairly similar to the X-15, except that it could take off on its own, unassisted. It didn't have to be dropped from a bomber. It was launched on a rocket. The two versions were called the Cosmoplane and Rocket Plane. And they actually did do a test of one in 1962, but it was unmanned. This little mock-up that you see right here, obviously it has a cockpit. This was actually never built. This is just a small model. The one that was actually built and actually flew was unmanned, and it was really just a capsule that separated from the booster rocket, and then it did a controlled re-entry. But that wasn't until 1962. They never flew a manned craft similar to the X-15. And if they did, it would have been after this, which is already more than a year after the Ludmila recording took place. So I wanted to think about, well, what about slow-moving, high-altitude planes? Something that gets high enough that maybe it could re-enter? I don't know. Just trying to look at all the possibilities. Remember Francis Gary Powers flying the American U-2 got shot down over Soviet Russia. Can you say Soviet Russia? Is that correct? Russian Soviets? I don't know. I'm terrible. But they made a copy of it. They called it the Beriev S-13. And this one was even funnier, the way that this got canceled. This plane was actually completely built, finished, ready to fly, except the engine wasn't done yet. The engine was behind schedule. It was being built at another factory. This design bureau got killed again, and all of the prototypes were ordered to be scrapped. They ordered this completed plane ready to fly to be disassembled and scrapped. The engineers said, no way. They took the wings off, put it into a truck, and kidnapped the plane. Supposedly, it's still sitting in a hangar someplace waiting to be discovered. But it never flew, and even that cancellation didn't happen until 1962, after the Ludmila recording. So what about just conventional jet fighters? Is it possible that she was just flying a regular conventional jet? Because women did fly jet fighters in that day. That was not unusual. The fastest plane that they had at the time was this particular one, this YE-50, which was built specifically to go after the American U-2 and shoot it down. And you can see sorry, I didn't put meters. How many meters is that? 20,000 meters? Mach 2.8. That's very fast, but it's not fast enough to have reentry heating. It's not fast enough that she's going to be saying things like, I can see flames, I feel hot, I'm going to reenter. It's just not that fast. The MiG-21 was an operational plane that was based on the same platform. It didn't have quite the specifications of the YE-150, but that's the plane that was already in mass production. So jet fighters, I just couldn't see that jet fighters were a plausible match for it. So this next one I think is very interesting. What do you think the requirements for women who wanted to get into the female cosmonaut program were? They had to be a certain size and weight, obviously, because the capsules had a certain size. But what do you think was the one skill that they needed? Anyone shout out a guess?
Seducing?
I hope I heard that wrong. It was parachuting. When Soviet capsules come back to Earth and they crash down, they just land on the ground. The guy's not in it anymore. He actually ejects at higher altitude and he comes down in a parachute. They don't simply get killed when the thing crashes. So they were looking for women who had parachuting ability. Well, look what was happening in the United States a year before the Ludmila recording took place. This guy, Joseph Kittinger, from Roswell Air Base in New Mexico, so there might be an alien connection here too. He was taking these high-altitude balloons up into space, and 614 miles an hour, that's just shy of the sound barrier. That's almost Mach 1 is the speed at which he was falling. Well, might he get hot? Might he say, I'm re-entering, I'm burning up, I can see flames? Is that plausible? Well, no, the exact opposite happened to Kittinger. One of his gloves was broken, the seal wasn't working right, and he got frostbite all over his hand. He was freezing to death up there. He never got hot, even when he was falling at Mach 1. So although this is a really interesting possibility, I don't think it's what Ludmila could have been doing. And at that point, I'd pretty much exhausted everything I could think of for who this woman was, if she was indeed someone who was up in the air doing something. So, how do we solve this mystery? Go back to the original source of the data and try and find out how reliable it was. In my case, I got my own Russian translators to see if the popular translation of what Ludmila was saying actually made any sense or not. Turns out it doesn't. These are my Russians, except Dunko, he's a Bulgarian, but he counts. So this is what the recording is supposed to say. You can find these words all over the internet. I've condensed it because it's quite long. It goes on for several minutes. But it's mostly these phrases repeated over and over again, particularly the phrase that's interpreted as, I'm hot, I'm hot. Let's see what she really said. First of all, the words that you see here on the screen were a very small part of the recording. Almost the whole thing was just a lot of numbers. She was repeating strings of numbers, series of numbers, over and over and over again. Sometimes she was counting, sometimes the numbers were kind of random. It would be 21, 22, 23, 24, 21, 22, and just on and on and on, repetitively. What does that mean? I don't know. It's interesting. When she says, isn't this dangerous? Help! Am I in a dangerous situation? Nobody heard anything like that. We didn't hear anything on the tape that could have been interpreted as that. And what about talk to me? A lot of these Russian translations are ambiguous. A phrase can mean one thing in one context and one thing in another context. And in this case, my Russians thought that she was saying, I will transmit or I will begin speaking now. It wasn't talk to me, it was I will speak now. And as far as I'm hot, I'm hot, she said this many, many times, but I got disagreement. Nobody heard I'm hot. They were saying don't give up and not right. One thing that I thought was interesting was two of my Russians said, She's saying, don't give up. And she's saying it to someone in an encouraging manner, like, you're doing good. Keep it up. Don't give up. Don't give up. So I'm thinking, you know, maybe she was talking to someone who's in a simulator or something like that. Maybe she's just in a ground control station and someone's in a capsule simulator or flying a plane or do something, and she's just talking him through the procedures. That's actually a reasonable possibility. What about I can see a flame? Again, nobody heard anything like I can see a flame. Am I going to crash? Nobody heard anything like, am I going to crash? A lot of this translation was, where it came from originally, one of the Judica Cordelia brothers' girlfriends spoke Russian. I wasn't able to determine if she was a native Russian speaker or if she just, you know, thought she knew enough Russian to be dangerous, but that's where this original translation came from. And I will re-enter, this one's interesting, it means it's time to come back now. Return, return is what my Russians thought she was saying. Now, I should qualify this that the recording is very, very garbled. Nobody had an easy time understanding any of it. So for you folks in the audience who raised your hand and said you want to speak Russian or you can speak Russian, I would love to hear your take on this. If you want to send me an email afterwards or talk to me and give me your email, I would love to give you the recording and have you tell me what you think it says. Because I'd love to improve this talk. It's a talk that I give a lot. So that's where we end up. The critical thinking process doesn't always take us to the answer, but at least we were able to learn a lot. A lot of this stuff is very fun, it's very interesting, and we were pretty much able to rule out conclusively that Ludmila was not a lost cosmonaut. But we had a lot of fun in the process. I want to point you to a couple of sources that I found very, very helpful in this. They were just terrific. This website, astronautics.com, you will find on this an incredible amount of information from the Soviet space program. A lot of those documents I talked about that have been declassified are now translated into English, maybe other languages, I'm not sure, and they're available on this. The website, lostcosmonauts.com, is a very popular one, and it's a completely credulous source, meaning it promotes what the Judica Cordelia brothers interpreted these recordings as. I think in quite an uncritical way. It simply just repeats the idea that, hey, this is a conspiracy theory and these people died in space. And then for information on these Soviet X-planes, these rocket planes and so forth that were either built or not built, I found a terrific book by Midland Publishers called Soviet X-Planes. So there's a lot of really good information in there. And that's the end of the talk. So and I actually talked five minutes faster than I meant to, so we have 5 minutes extra for Q&A.
Questions, I guess. Well, thank you very much, Brian. Are there any questions? There are two mics in the aisles. If you've got a question, please walk to the mic, and Brian will answer them.
If anyone's curious, if you see this drawing that's on here while you're thinking of your questions, can you read what it says right there? And who knows what that later became, where that name was used again. That is the Russian space shuttle, that's right. This was an early prototype. This was a scramjet. You can see the compressor cone on the front of it there that was launched with some sort of a chemical-powered rocket. This is just a concept drawing. Nothing like this was built, but it was called the Buran, and that's where the name came from. Usually there's a big long line of people up here trying to challenge me on the moon hoax, the moon landing hoax, and 9/11 and everything else. But,
but over here,
I'm happy to talk about anything. Yeah.
Huh? Over here, nobody has any questions about that.
No?
No.
Yes, they do. We had pub nights last night and the night before with some of my listeners who are here in Berlin. And there's quite a lot of that. One guy must have had about 6 beers, and he wanted to launch into the 9/11 conspiracy. It's a... No, I don't have a presentation about that. I don't want to talk about that.
Okay, so no questions at all. Well, yes, please walk to the mic and you can ask your question.
Oh. Well, in that context, I ran around something that General Vladimir Ilyushin should have been the first Russian cosmonaut. And there was some kind of an interview where he said, yes, it is true, I was the first, I burned somehow up during reentry. And could you say
a thing? Vladimir Ilyusha, I don't know a whole lot about this. I know a little bit, and mostly what I came across while I was researching this particular topic. Vladimir Ilyushin, is that close enough to the correct pronunciation? He's another Soviet cosmonaut, and he's still alive to this day. And he claims that he launched, in place of Gagarin, he actually flew. It might have been he may have said he flew the day before or the same day, but his craft didn't make it into orbit. There was some problem with the engines, and he crash-landed without completing a single orbit in China. And he bailed out like he was supposed to. He was captured by the Chinese. He had a very serious leg injury. And the Chinese held him in captivity, basically, as a political prisoner for a year before they finally returned him to the Soviet Union. And he maintains to this day that that's what actually happened and that Gagarin was just a smiling young face that they took out. They took the backup capsule. They took it and they made it look like it crash-landed somewhere in Siberia. And they pulled Gagarin out and he came out with his big, happy smile and became the national hero. So that is that's a topic that I really look forward into researching in more detail. It doesn't require the great leaps of logic that you'd have to make for the Ludmila recording to be true, for example. So that, you know, that's one that's a little bit more plausible. It is in character with what the Soviets would have done. You know, one of the other recordings that was on here, the heartbeat, the SOS. Just the doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo that was going straight away from the Earth. That's been interpreted as, well, maybe something went wrong on one of the engines. They went off course, and it just started going off, lost into space. The problem with that is that the Vostok R-7 booster at that time could not launch more than 500 kilograms into low Earth orbit. It certainly could not launch a capsule with a man in it out of orbit. They had flown Luna probes. There was a series of probes called the Lunas that flew actually past the moon. But that was just a tiny little box like this big was all it was. It was not the size and weight of a capsule. They simply didn't have any hardware capable of launching someone into orbit at all, certainly not out of orbit, that could have made that Morse code recording. So we have, you know, there's other good reasons why most of these other recordings cannot possibly be what they've popularly been interpreted as. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I have a question once more regarding the Ludmila recording. You said that the Italian brothers had the possibility of triangulating in order to determine that the signal actually comes from space. And if that is true, I don't see how it could be some kind of ground control in a simulator.
How it could be some kind of a ground control in simulator? I don't have the data on the Ludmila recording for what they said the speed and the altitude was. So that might be a valid criticism. It might not. I don't know. Another thing that's been put forward as a guess is something called moon bounce or radio repeaters. Sometimes they would land in the early 1960s, we were starting to launch small little satellites around that were just used as a radio repeater, so you could do line of sight radio broadcasting around the curvature of the Earth. Those were not yet in place at the time that these recordings took place, so you can't say that the Ludmila recording sounds like it was coming from orbit because it was bouncing off of one of these radio repeaters. That's not possible because the radio repeaters didn't exist. So what about moon bounce? Moon bounce is where you take a signal, you shoot it at the moon, and it bounces back to Earth. It's another way of kind of doing a poor man's communication satellite. Moon bounce is a possibility. I don't know enough about it to determine if what I read was true or not, because I found sources on both sides that said this could have possibly happened, some that said couldn't possibly have happened. So I don't know about that. But again, you wouldn't have the same speed and altitude data, that you wouldn't have the Doppler effect.
Okay, thank you.
Not particular question, but thank you for talking here. I'm a great fan of your podcast.
Oh, thank you very much.
One little thing maybe. Please use metric.
What's that?
Please use metric.
I know. I usually give this in the United States, and that's one thing. Yesterday I realized, I got to go through that and change it.
Totally excuse. So just be...
No, that's a perfectly valid... But doesn't it make me seem more foreign and exotic being here, coming?
Yeah. No, it would make it much more easy to listen to. I'm getting into the imperial system, but it's really strange.
Guilty is charged. I have no excuse. Thank you.
Thank you.
Regarding the Ludmilla recording, you mentioned that there was a long sequence in it where the voice just repeats certain numbers. Do you know about so-called number stations?
Number stations, yes. I did a podcast episode on number stations. Number stations are relatively new. They started, I believe, around the 1970s. There are examples going all the way back to the 1940s, but they didn't really explode in popularity until the 1970s. Number stations, for those who haven't heard, are on the shortwave radio bands. I mean, you can go to your local electronics store and you can buy a shortwave radio receiver and you can tune into these number stations. And you listen to it, and at the same time of the day, every day, sometimes several times a day, sometimes several times a week, but always on a regular schedule, you'll hear an electronic voice saying, 1, 7, 5, 3. 1, 7, 5, 3. Actually, it's sequences of five numbers because it's encryption. Some of them start with a funny little musical cue. There's one out of Great Britain that starts with a song called the Lincolnshire Poacher. This little musical cue, and then it goes into the numbers. There's one called Yosemite Sam that comes out of the southwestern United States that starts with, "I'm gonna get you, varmint," from a Bugs Bunny cartoon, and then it goes into repeating these numbers. So people have always wondered what the heck these were, and people have used triangulation again to try and zero in on where they're coming from, because you can use a direction finder, a radio direction finder, and you can track down where the station's coming from. The Lincolnshire Poacher is coming from the British military station on Gibraltar. And the Yosemite Sam one is coming from the White Sands Missile Base in southwestern United States. So they appear to be military. They're probably being used to transmit instructions to intelligence operatives somewhere in the world. And the reason this is such a good way to do it is because it's very low tech. And the communication goes all the way around the world. It goes through walls. It can reach people wherever they are. Wherever they are. And they can just go to any local electronics store and they can buy a receiver for these. And there's been two cases in the United States that I know of where Cuban spies were arrested for espionage. And part of the evidence against them was that it was found that they were listening in to a Cuban number station called Atencion. And they were entering the numbers into a laptop computer, which was decrypting a message and giving them their instructions, whatever it is they were supposed to do that day in a James Bond kind of way. But yes, number stations are a fascinating one. And it's great because that's a conspiracy theory that actually turns out to be true. So thank you for that.
All right. Thanks.
Hi. As a person living in a country where a lot of the daily TV intake is being subtitled, I was not at all surprised to see a botched translation from such a difficult source material. But my question is, has this in any way changed the way you do research? And do you use the internet to find
people? Yes, it has.
And do this help at all, or do your readers or listeners just add more conspiracy theories?
Yeah, it certainly alerted me to the fact that you need to get native speakers involved whenever there's a foreign language. And a great example of that recently, there's a phenomenon in China. Has anyone ever heard of the Baigong Pipes? Supposedly there's this cave, few people, supposedly there's a cave in China that's in limestone, and it's got these pipes, these metal pipes, manufactured metal pipes, sticking up out of the ground. Something like 150,000 years old is what the pipes have been dated for. They're sticking out the top of the mound. There's a lake nearby, and they're sticking up in the beach. And the popular story, as it's believed in China, that this is an ancient alien construction project from 150,000 years ago where they're building some sort of an elaborate plumbing system. Now, it's embedded in natural rock that is older than 150,000 years. It's the metal itself that's been dated to that. And it's the kind of thing where, gee, nobody has any natural explanation for what it is. Well, I got a hold of some Chinese articles from Chinese newspapers and from some Chinese geology journals, And it turns out that good Chinese scientists have studied this and have come up very conclusively with what the answer is. It's something that's found all over the world. We've got a lot of them in the United States that I found examples of. It's basically the fossilized casts of trees. In this case, it's fossilized bamboo, which is why the pipes seem to be quite long and straight. It's just a cast, this material that collected around the bamboo. It then died, got buried up in flood rubble. And over the eons, these fossilized casts got washed down from the canyons into the basin where they are today, what later became this cave. So they actually are much, much older than 150,000 years. They were dated to that by a dating method that would be valid if they were metal that had been heated and forged 150,000 years ago. Well, that's not the case. They're millions of years old, and they're fossilized bamboo casts. That's much more interesting than saying, oh, it must have been an alien construction project. And there's no way that I would have gotten that information if I didn't have authentic Chinese-speaking researchers helping me out on that. Yeah.
Yes, hello. Is there any information that indicates that the two Italian brothers may have given us false information?
No, it's certainly possible. But there were so many other people in the room when they were doing this. It was corroborated. Sometimes they were tipped off by other radio observatories around the world. They say, hey, we're hearing something strange on channel 1000. Tune in and record what it is. So, yes, it's possible that they were hoaxing. I think it's more likely that they were wrongly interpreting what they heard. I think they did record what they say they recorded. They just interpreted it, I think, badly. Okay. There's a movie about these two guys that you can find chopped up into five or six segments on YouTube called Space Hackers. It's in Italian. It's subtitled in English. But it's very interesting. It gives all the details on these two brothers. There's a lot of film of them working in the observatory. You can see all the other people who were in there with them. Like I said, university professors, people from Italian intelligence. I don't believe that they were hoaxing us. I think that they were honest in what they were trying to do. They were all self-taught. Also, everything that they figured out about the Doppler effect and how to calculate speed and altitude were things they figured out themselves. They even figured out one of the American space frequencies so they could listen in on the, would have been the Apollo, no, the Gem, Mercury flights, the Mercury flights. The way they figured it out, there was a picture of Alan Shepard being taken out of the capsule when it was in the water. And their father, being a medical doctor, told him, I think he said it would be 8 inches would be the distance from here to here or here, something like that. They used some metric on the human head, and they compared that to the antenna that was on top of the capsule. And by talking to some radio friend of theirs, they figured out that they could calculate the length of the antenna and therefore the frequency of the signal that it was designed to optimally receive. That was kind of the sort of the hacker mentality that these two guys had. They were very clever.
Okay. Any more questions for Brian?
That means Okay. Everyone knows everything or nobody knows anything.
Brian, is there anything you need from the audience?
Like I said, I think it would be great if anyone who speaks Russian would like to give a shot at listening to that tape for me and seeing what you could find out. Otherwise, what I need you to do is go to skeptoid.com and subscribe to my podcast and send money today. I also accept beer.
Okay, well, I think what we learned is that critical thinking is very important. Know all the facts before you come to a conclusion.
You will have more fun finding out the facts than stopping at the popular conclusion.
Okay, so we will. Thank you very much. I hope you want to give your feedback on the website. What do you think about Brian's lecture? Well, thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much. Thank you.